This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 149. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. Today, you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers from all around the world, all sitting down virtually. Some of us are sweating out on the treadmill. Others are commuting to work, and we are all getting our photography nerdery on in this podcast. So we have a ton for you in this episode. We're going to talk a lot about flash photography, shooting groups, winter photography. We're going to talk about SEO for your photography website, and even sharpening in Lightroom and Photoshop. But this is a big week for us. And for me, it's like this is crunch time for the whole year. So all year long, I prepare a Lightroom training and Lightroom presets for Black Friday. And you guys, if you've been around Improved Photography for a couple of years, you already know all about the Lightroom Steel. It's incredibly, incredibly popular. You know, I don't know what all the other websites are doing, but I've got to think the Lightroom Steel is the most popular collection of Lightroom presets out there. We've just had rave reviews the last couple of years, and I have a brand new collection that I've been preparing all year long for our Black Friday launch. But in addition to that, I also have a training on Lightroom. And this week, I mean, I have not slept. I woke up at 2:30 this morning. I got to the computer, started editing. I mean, I've barely left the house in the last 4 days. I've spent 30 hours in editing this video training on flash photography. I don't know. I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be cool. I think everybody's going to love it. But it's definitely crunch time for us. So if you notice some snores or me nodding off during the podcast, just know I woke up at 2:20 to start editing video for you guys. All right. The question of the week is from Nick Len from Washington, USA. And he asks, I'd love to hear you guys talk about sharpening. Do you use masking when you're in Lightroom? What about in Photoshop? You know, in Photoshop, there are a million different masking modes, de-blur versus sharpening. Just basically, how do you do it? So Nick, I'm going to toss this one to you. So, you know, you've got to edit a portrait. Like, walk me through your workflow of what you do.
Pretty much for every single photo that I do, I mask out some of the sharpening in Lightroom. When you import a photo into Lightroom, it comes with the default settings where it's sharpening absolutely everything in the photo. It's not being selective at all with what it is sharpening. It's just sharpening everything. And when you go to your detail panel, there's the masking slider. And as you drag that to the right, it begins to be more and more selective with what it's sharpening. So the first thing I do with every single photo, doesn't matter whether it's a landscape or a portrait, I mask out some of that sharpening.
Tell me this. So like when you're in Photoshop and you're masking something out, you're like painting as if with an adjustment brush, right? You're painting spots that it's applying the effect or not. So this is just a slider. It's a global slider, affects the whole picture, this masking slider. So tell us what that masking slider is in the sharpening panel in Lightroom. Like what exactly does it do?
Right. So as you slide this to the right, it begins to hone in on the edges that it sees in the photo. So like if it's all the way to the left where it's masking everything, it's sharpening the sky as much as it is the trees and the vegetation in the shot.
But the out of focus background, right, as exactly. Much as the eyes.
And by doing that, you're actually adding noise back into your photo that doesn't need to be there. So by masking out some of that sharpness, by sliding it to the right, you get nice clean skies. And so what I do is I hold down the Alt key, I slide the masking slider to the right until I'm happy with what it is sharpening. If it's a landscape, I slide that to the right until it's no longer trying to sharpen the sky or, you know, the clouds, things that I don't really want sharpened.
And right. Then, so when you're holding the Alt key or option on a Mac and you move this slider in Lightroom, it's showing you what is being sharpened and what is no longer being sharpened. So if I do this on a portrait, when I start, shows everything. It's sharpening the whole thing. And then as I slide to the right, I can see it's sharpening less and less on the background, and eventually it's only hitting the person because the background's blurry. Exactly.
So you should say the what's in white is being sharpened and what's in black is not.
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it starts out entirely white. It's a wholly white screen. And then as you slide that slider over to the right, more and more and more goes black until you can kind of see exactly the details that you're trying to sharpen is in white.
And that's kind of what is so nice about Lightroom is this is so easy compared to Photoshop. With Photoshop, you have to create a layer and then you're painting in your sharpness and stuff. And there's multiple steps. But in Lightroom, it's really, really easy. Like you have your details panel. And then the other thing that I like to do is add a little bit of sharpness to an adjustment brush and then just paint in a little bit more extra sharpness. And even when I'm taking a landscape photo over into Photoshop and I'm doing all this luminosity masks and all this other crazy stuff, I still do all my sharpening back in Lightroom. And typically that's like my last step. I'll do all of my crazy fancy stuff and then I'll go back into Lightroom, add some sharpness, and voila, it's done. So I do all of my sharpening in Lightroom.
Very cool. Yeah. And so this is the sharpening, the main file. Then you may want to do some output sharpening, you know, more sharpening if you're going to print on a matte paper, less sharpening if it's going to be a glossy paper, that kind of thing. But just for sharpening the photo, I do the same thing. I use Lightroom to do this, and it does really, really well. Yes, you're going to have a million more options for sharpening in Photoshop. Frankly, I don't remember the last time that I was like, oh man, this needs Photoshop Smart Sharpen. This just isn't going to work in Lightroom. Like it never happens that I like, oh man, I need a different sharpening algorithm. I just don't need that.
Exactly.
I just don't need it. The one in Lightroom does a fine job, and usually it's only like a tiny bit of sharpening that I'm adding anyway to the photos. And frankly, if your photo's going out on the web, people are barely even going to be able to notice because they smush the crud out of the photos to make them small so the page loads faster anyway.
In fact, if you over sharpen and you put it out there on the web in a small format, it can look really strange and
super
crunchy.
Weird. Yeah. Especially if you're like making a little thumbnail, when it gets made into a thumbnail, it looks super strange.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And some of my earlier work, it really was over sharpened. And that's when I realized I needed to practice better sharpening methods inside Lightroom, because I was actually taking a photo into Photoshop to use a third party software like Nick or Topaz Labs, something like that, to sharpen it. And then I realized once I know how to use the masking, the slider that Nick was talking about, and I just learned about using the Alt or Option key for that, the sharpening can be done in a much more efficient manner inside Lightroom itself.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people just overthink sharpness, because you know, so many photos that I see when I'm giving critiques and stuff, they're just over sharpened. And the only thing worse than a shot that is not super sharp is one that is way over sharpened. And there's a lot of those floating around, and it's better to err on the side of tasteful and discreet when it comes to sharpening. You don't want to go super ultra crazy with it, because it can really ruin a photo pretty quick.
Okay, so what level, what numbers are you talking about in Lightroom then? For the sharpness value itself, how far is it different depending on your subject?
Yeah, it's totally depending on my subject.
It is for me too.
I would say it's rare that I push it past half.
Right, totally agree. The only exception to that will be if I'm painting in some sharpness. Sometimes I will, in that detail panel, I will bring the sharpness up to about half. And I like to play with a radius slider as well. I like to turn that down. That way it's a really fine sharpness that it's adding, rather than a big, bulky, like crunchy sharpness. And each type of sharpness has its own adjective. But not the big crunchy stuff. But the
crunchy, poppy.
Yeah. I like mine crispy, not crunchy.
That's interesting. See, I usually do the opposite. I usually take my radius up to about 1.3. I'm going to have to experiment with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I go down a lot, especially on portrait. I move the radius down.
Very interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm with Jim on boosting it, so we're torn.
Well, there's a lot to know with sharpness, but I think if you really just take that simple approach, you're going to do just fine. You really shouldn't have problems with the photos if you just take that basic approach to sharpening. Another question we got this week on our Facebook page is about SEO specifically for a photography website. So for the uninitiated, SEO means search engine optimization. And it just means that when somebody types in Columbus, Ohio photographer, that Erica Kay should show up number one because she's the best. But Google has to decide if Erica Kay goes first or if Tom Slaughter goes first, you know, if Cobra Commander comes up first. It's got to decide which website ranks first, second, third, etc. So for photographers, this is a big deal. In fact, I just got a client this week that wants to outfit an office with landscapes, with prints, all from SEO. Somebody searched Idaho landscapes. My photo came up, got to my contact information, and she's opening an office and wants to order prints for the office. So that's what we want. That's the scenario that we want as photographers. It's basically free and very targeted advertising for your photography. Now, how do you get a website to rank? I guess I should say first, I think I'm in a unique position to answer this. In addition to Improve Photography, I also run a little known fact. I run actually quite a few other websites, one on knife reviews, one on owning a pontoon boat, all kinds of different things. I own several other websites, even a baseball website, and I don't even like baseball. So I get to see the stats, the Google Analytics from all of those websites, and I can make changes on them and see what actually brings up the SEO rating and what actually can drop it down. And I am firmly convinced. I have tried every trick and shortcut in the book. And I'm very convinced that if you want your website to do well, all you need to do is follow Google's guidelines, write great content, and your website is going to rank how it's supposed to be ranking. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if I write an article on improved photography, let's say I write it about a big keyword, a keyword that's been written about tens of thousands of times, like what's the best camera? There are tens of thousands of articles about that. And so the chances of me ranking for the best camera are very low. Even on improved photography that ranks very well in Google, there's no way we're going to rank for that if I just write a quick 500-word article on, like, I think it's the Canon Rebel T5i. That's not going to work. It's not interesting enough. The people who go to the page aren't going to like it enough. And so it's not going to rank well in Google. Now, let's say I put, you know, a full week's work into making this perfect article that, like, is the best answer to finding the best camera. And I make it, I put it out there, I put a ton of work into it. It may take a while, sometimes months, but if your article is the best, I almost always find that Google is eventually going to rank you at number one. And so some principles that you can follow to make your photography website stand out. Number one, you have to have more than images. If you just have images and like a little title, a one sentence explanation, good luck, buddy. You're never going to rank. You need to have big, fat, meaty articles with excellent information if you want to rank. So if I'm Erica Kay and I want to rank for Columbus area photographer, which she should because she's amazing, then I'm going to write, I'm not just going to post photo after a photo. Google can't, I mean, that's not a result. It's just going to show me a picture and that's it. And then I'm going to leave the website. If I'm looking for a wedding photographer in Columbus, Ohio, I might search best places to get married in Columbus, Ohio. And so Erica Kay writes an excellent article saying, hey, I've photographed 200 weddings in this town, and these are the best places to get married. They look gorgeous in your photos, etc. Or somebody says, somebody searching wedding dress shops in Columbus, Ohio. And she says, hey, I've worked with 200 brides. I've seen a bunch of wedding dresses. I know which companies are good to work with and which are a pain. And these are the ones that I can recommend for you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're writing about things that people interested in getting married are going to be searching. Or for Idaho, I got like that perfect email saying, hey, I want to buy a bunch of prints for my whole office. Well, I need to be writing articles like, bulk landscape photography or bulk Idaho fine art photography or outfitting an office in Idaho with landscape photography or, Idaho landscape photography for corporations. I need to be writing big articles on that. Answer the questions that they're going to have. How much is it going to cost? How big of a print do they need? How many prints do they need? How long will they last, etc. So if you're writing that great content, you're going to do well, but you aren't going to do well if you're just posting photos. But stop looking for silver bullets in SEO. You will find many, many, many people willing to sell you shortcuts, and I promise they will not work.
So what advice do you have for, say, a Washington State photographer that is really lazy, really lazy and hates to write? What kind of advice do you have for me, Jim?
Well, you could do videos. Videos shows up very well in Google. In fact, some of the articles that we write that have done very well in the past now have videos ranking above them because people want to click on a video in the search result page. And so you could do exactly all the things that I just said, but do it on a YouTube channel and keep referring people back to your website to then hire you as a photographer.
What about this idea? Before we started, we talked about how there's people out there you can pay to help you with your SEO. You can invest some money and they'll go
some money?
Yeah, they'll go do all those techie things that nobody, you know, we don't want to even discuss because it's not worthwhile. But instead of doing that, Nick, the idea could be that you hire someone to write some really nice long blog post. You could give them some information about like the geolocation from your pictures or something so that they will do it. But hire someone to go build you some posts, create some posts for you.
That sounds like a lot of work. I don't know if I'm up for that. Like,
well, yeah, that's actually a great strategy though, Jeff. That's something that I've done with a lot of the websites that I run is I'll just hire somebody to, you know, I'll write, hey, I want an article on these different topics, and they'll write them, you know, for a website like baseball that I don't know anything about. So I'll find somebody that knows something about baseball and pay them to write articles on that website. So anyway, it's an interesting thing, but you know, I've been a little bit cynical on SEOs in general, you know, people that you can pay to do work on your website. So there are definitely mistakes you can make that will keep you from ranking well in search engines. Absolutely. And the reason that I'm kind of cynical on it is I don't see anything that I have ever paid money for that has done any good for me. I feel like I've gotten to the competent level. And at this point, I just need to write good content. But if you're very, very much not technical and you're running your website by yourself, then yeah, you might want to pay somebody to check on a couple things. But here's the thing, like 95% of the people you're going to find who do SEO work do not know what they're talking about. I bet I meet an SEO a month. You know, there are a lot of them. It's a pretty common job where I live that will, you know, go to small businesses and help their websites to rank well on Google. And, you know, I see the actual data of what works on websites and what doesn't. And I always ask them about the things they're doing. And I say, man, that's crap. Like, I've tried those things. That isn't going to be the thing to give these small businesses a bump. So it's tough to hire somebody who's actually reputable and is actually going to do a good job for you. All right. So that's a little bit about SEO for photography websites. It's kind of a tough thing to get right. But you know what? Just ignore all of the technical details, put your head down and write great content, and you'll probably do just fine. This is where having something like Squarespace, somebody who's going to manage your website for you, is already going to do all the technical stuff that you could get wrong for you. And at that point, you're just plowing forward. Squarespace isn't the right thing for everybody. ImproveFotography.com isn't run on Squarespace. It's a very large website. That's not really what Squarespace is meant for. We need something really, really robust. We have, you know, millions of people that come to the website. But, you know, for a photography portfolio, perfect. It takes care of all the technical stuff for you, and you can just work on writing. This is starting to sound like an unpaid ad, but it's just because I like them. All right. We have a lot more to talk about today. Darren, you wanted to talk about some tips for shooting in cold weather. Let's hear it.
Yeah, it seems like this time of the year, I find myself being really tempted just to hunker down, grab some blankets and not go out and shoot. And so I thought, you know, what better thing to talk about than braving the cold weather that we have going on in certain parts of the world and not getting rusty over the winter. And one thing I found is our weather's transitioning is that the calm before the storm usually has a spike in temperatures, which is definitely a plus, but also it creates these really cool misty days. Like you'll be walking outside and it'll look really dreary and cloudy. And then you'll walk outside again after you grab a soda or something like that. And you'll notice that there's this mist everywhere and it makes what's left of the fall foliage kind of pop off trees. You can, if you can somehow wrangle up someone to shoot some photos of, whether it be a family member or a model swap or something like that, you can really create some moody looking shots for portraits and landscapes both. And I think that this is really important because if you're out shooting, then you're keeping the axe sharp. But also, I equate it to sports like golf, and you need to prepare yourself and prepare your gear for the cooler conditions. You can definitely golf during the winter. It's not recommended, but I think you should definitely shoot photos during the winter. And there's certain advice that we've dropped on the show in the past and kind of maybe forgot about over the summer as it's warmer. But after listening to Nick mentions that one of our good friends, Zach Blackwood, it uses hand warmers to wrap around his lens with rubber bands. I used that out in Bryce Canyon when it was really cold when we were in Utah. And it turned out really amazing. So tips like that to keep your gear acclimated and ready for shooting in the winter is also a huge thing to do. Another thing that I noticed is that if you go to your hardware store, you can winterize your tripod. And it's going to look kind of funny. And I wondered why Jim's tripod in the beginning of Improved Photography looks so darn weird. It's because I think he did this. He went and grabbed the pipe insulators that you see on hot pipes and whatnot in your house that are going down to your hot water heater. But he put those insulators on there. And what type of tape did you put on the legs of your tripod, Jim?
Duct tape.
Duct tape. Yeah, I would say duct tape or medical tape is what I bought. I can definitely see the medical tape kind of going a little less white, more beige and dirty throughout this the winter. But I have an aluminum body tripod, and boy, does that bugger get cold. I can feel it's cold going right through the thin slate of my gloves. So I definitely say winterizing your tripod can definitely help make you more apt to go out and shoot, and especially bring the tripod to get those nice landscape shots. Next,
tripod winterization. You just opened up a whole new industry, Darren.
Yep.
I know. See, there you go. That's a good way we could possibly start writing articles on our website about that and get people over there with SEO, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Right on. And another idea that I had is just look at the details. Some of the coolest shots that I've seen, especially some that have come out of our most recent workshop, were people taking pictures of ice swirling around in rivers. Some of those details I didn't really notice. And when Jim and I are sitting there looking at those portfolio reviews and giving people a pat on the back and giving them constructive advice in their photos, that's one thing that comes out of both of our mouths and I think has come out of Nick's mouth sometimes when looking at them as well, is like, that's a really cool pattern. That's something I probably stepped on and crushed, you know, because it's ice, but it's really neat that you caught that. And I think that you could easily occupy your time in the winter just by taking pictures of the little nuances that snow, ice, and fog and other things create during the winter times. Last but not least, if you're a portrait photographer, we talked about this on the most recent episode of the Portrait Session podcast, but bring things to keep your clients cozy, like wrap a scarf around their noses and their ears to keep them from going red. And then also scout your local area to see if there's studio space available for you to rent. I know that's kind of pricey for some people, but if you're in a bracket to where you're charging enough to where you can build studio time into your session, it might be a better and more viable idea versus going out and braving sub-zero temperatures. And the main thing I want to drive home is just don't stop shooting. You need to keep that axe sharp.
Very good. Today, I want to talk a little bit about some of the portrait photography that I've been doing for the Lightroom Steel. So, I'm really excited about the presets. I mean, I put all year long as we go out and do these free photography workshops with readers of Improved Photography. Like I'm creating new presets as we go. So I get different ideas and they're presets that will apply to a bunch of different situations because I'm going everywhere and trying to shoot different things and creating presets that work in a lot of different areas. So I'm excited about the presets, but you know, maybe I'm just as excited in this year's Lightroom Steel about the flash photography training. This it's almost 2 hours long, and I've condensed it as much as possible. I mean, this is a very watchable 2 hours. You will not be bored. And what I did is I rented out a studio in Boise. And I taught a group of photographers. We had, you know, 5, 6, 7 photographers there in a live class so that they could stop me and say, hey, you know, you said something that didn't make sense or something, and ask questions. So it kept it very real for all of the sit down training kind of part of it. And then we went out and did a ton of shooting in there. I mean, there's a lot of on location in the video training. So the first one I did was shooting my kids in the living room of my house. Like, it was a real challenge to create something like really cool, professional looking and conceptual conceptual, just in a living room. Then I shot a dancer in just a public park, and there were like these ugly fences and horses behind us. And then I shot a photo of somebody in the backyard and a sports action portrait in the backyard. And then I did professional headshots just on a plain white background. So they're all like very real locations, like that anybody can access. You don't, it's not very hard to get to these locations. I had no real models in the whole DVD. They're all just normal people. And the most gear that I used on a particular shoot was, I guess I used 3 flashes in some of them, but they're all like $70 YN560s and like a $10 umbrella. I used 1 umbrella or 1 softbox on each of the shoots. So it's like bare bones gear, horrible locations, and no models. And it was so cool to like force myself to work with those limitations that I know most of you deal with every day. And so I think it's going to be a really helpful training for that reason. So check it out. It's going to cost $147 on improvephotography.com. But if you get the Lightroom Steel, it's included in there. And the whole Lightroom Steel is only $39.99. So don't miss it on Black Friday or else it's gone. I want to walk you through one of them that I did. I talked about this briefly on an episode of the podcast months ago, because I've been working on this project all year long. And it's the Kissing in the Rain photo. So it did really, really well on social media. What I did is I got sprinkler pipe and I put it on top of light stands. So it was, you know, really high, twice as tall as I am up in the sky. And it was just shooting water, you know, it's a sprinkler shooting water into the sky. We did it at night. And then we had a couple and, you know, the guy's in a white shirt. So his shirt turned see-through. And then it's this couple just making out in the rain. So it's, if you've ever seen like the cover of Notebook, that was the inspiration for this. It's my wife's like favorite movie. So that was kind of the inspiration for this picture. And it was so cool. Like, this is an awesome idea if you're a professional photographer. After I did this shoot, I didn't count, but I'm guessing it was about 20 couples, a lot of them that I'd never even met before. It sent me personal Facebook messages. Some people called me and were like, asking, please, how much is it going to cost me for me to book a shoot for you to do that with me? Of like, you know, the husband and wife making out in the rain. The photos turned out really cool. If you're a professional photographer, seriously, is a fun idea. So check that out in the DVD as well. I kind of wanted to point these things out because I get the stats on how many people stream the videos after purchase. And sometimes I'm so disappointed that people love the presets, but they never quite get around to watching some of the video trainings. Seriously, don't miss this one in the Lightroom Steel. Because there's some really, really cool things in there.
I've had a chance to watch some of these. I don't think I was supposed to, but I did anyways.
Whatever.
And the production value on all of this stuff is really, really high. Like, really well done videos. And the whole Kissing in the Rain photo shoot was really fun to watch. Really cool stuff. So highly recommend this. This video alone is worth what you're selling the Lightroom Steel for.
Yeah, and after following Jim throughout the years, it just seems like he keeps outdoing himself as far as the value for this. And if you've purchased previous Lightroom Steels, you're going to get different presets, but also this training here, it's going to blow your socks off. If your socks are still on when you're done watching it, you're a crazy person.
No socks in this tutorial.
No socks.
Anyway, it's something I'm pretty excited about to share with you how I got some of those photos that I've been sharing for the last year as I've been filming it. And the production value that you mentioned, Nick, that's all thanks to Micah Ness. Many of you know I was on the Oregon workshop, and so many of you may know him from there. He did all the videography for this. All right, Jeff, you want to talk about shooting large groups? Let's hear that.
Yeah, so I thought I would take our audience with me on this learning adventure. I'm doing a shoot I've never done before. That's not true. I've done shoots like this, but not without the lighting. So what is happening is there's a family that I know fairly well who is having a big gathering the day before Thanksgiving. And so there's going to be 30, 40 people. It's the first time this family's come together. It's a little bit sad. Well, not that sad, I guess. There's a funeral that they're coming. The great grandfather of the family's passed. And
I was going to say, why is it not that sad?
They're coming. Yeah, it was, okay. You know, it's a good thing the man was ready to go. So anyway, they're coming. This family hasn't been together in this kind of a group for a very long time. And so they wanted to get a photo, and they knew that I did photography. And I said, great, except I don't have a clue how where we're going to do this. I normally go out into a big area, lots of sunshine. We try to go an hour or so before sunset so that we can get good light. And it works great. But on the day before Thanksgiving here in Utah, that is going to be extremely dark, especially because several of the people they live locally here, and they can't get away from school or work until 5 p.m. And it's going to be pretty much pitch black by the time it's 5 p.m. So natural light is just out. It's not going to work. And they've reserved a lodge where they're going to go and meet. And that should be a pretty nice setting, but it still means I have to figure out how to light a very large group of people with flash. I have to do that. So I've never done that before, and I'm going to be learning how to do this. I hope I have everything set up right, and I'm excited to go give it a try. So I asked Jim for some advice before saying I'd go do this shoot, and he said, oh, this is simple. This is two silvers and a flash in the middle. What's a silver? And I mean, I had a good guess, but I had to make sure. So it's a silver umbrella. And so it's two umbrellas on either side that are silver. You'll mount the flash and point the flash into the umbrella and then have the umbrella facing the crowd. Is that right, Jim?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So you don't directly put the flash onto the group. You mount the flash to a light stand and have the umbrella there, so the flash points into the umbrella, and that goes on the group. And then one flash in the middle, those two flashes at 1/4 power. And then one flash in the middle, because it won't quite evenly light the group with just those two, the people in the middle would end up a little darker. So you need one flash in the middle at full power, and that should provide nice even lighting across the whole group so that we can get all of them in the shot indoors. So I'll be giving that a go. I had to go get some gear to make it work because I didn't have this stuff. But it's not very expensive. You can get this gear really cheap. Two 43-inch umbrellas that are silver on the inside and black on the outside. I had to get another light stand. I only had one, so I had to buy another light stand. I had to get a flash. I decided I was going to get a controller to better control the three flashes at once. But all of it, I think I've spent less than $200 on all the gear so far, and expect to be able to have it for this and then everything else I do in the future with the portrait stuff. So I'll kind of report back in a few weeks.
Very cool. Great. One thing I would add to this outside of the lighting is that anytime you're doing a really large group like this, you need to shoot at a longer focal length. And the reason for that is because if you shoot really wide, the people in the front row are going to look huge. The people in the back row look teeny tiny. So the longer the focal length, the more you compress all the faces together, and the more they all look like they're the same size humans. So,
and I need to go check out the lodge. I haven't seen yet where they're going to do. I'm a little worried I'm not going to have enough room to back up and use a long focal length. So I'm going to have to go see what it is. But I'll have to deal with whatever the environment is and do the best I can.
May the force be with you, Jeff.
So, Nick, I'm interested to hear how things have gone for you with the new Lightroom update. I was excited when it came out and downloaded it immediately, and I've kind of got my take on it, but what have you thought?
Before I get into the Lightroom update, I have a bone to pick. Jim and I, we both had the opportunity to do some night photography when we were in Utah.
I wondered about that.
And, you know, we hadn't really talked about it. So I thought I would bring it up, like, hey, what's the deal with our little night photography shootout thing? So when are we going to post photos? That's what I'm curious of.
That is a fine question. You know what? I just barely, 2 seconds ago, and I'm holding it in my hand, took out the memory card from that camera. So I haven't even seen my pictures yet. I hope I pulled something out.
Well, that's
if
perfect.
You see Nick's beautiful masterpiece and then my like weird Picasso looking thing, it's because Yeah, it didn't turn out so good.
Okay, so while I have you here, while we're live and on the spot, tonight,
the challenge.
Tonight, or let's say tomorrow, let's say tomorrow, we'll make a post to one of the pages. You want to do the Improved Photography Podcast listeners page, and we'll post both the photos anonymously somehow. We'll have somebody else post them.
I'll post them.
People get to vote on which one they think is which and which one they like better. How about that?
This must mean that your photo turned out good. I'm trying to import as fast as possible to see if I should take this challenge.
I think you're already in, Jim.
You don't have a choice. You're in.
All right. I'm in. Let's do it.
All right. All right. You heard it here, folks.
Let's set a deadline on when this photo has to get posted.
Let's post it tomorrow, which will be the same day that it comes out.
Like noon?
We'll do tomorrow evening.
High noon.
I can feel the sweat beating on Jim's forehead over there. So let's give him until tomorrow night to work some magic on this photo. So
yeah, we'll see what we pulled out. Okay. All right, good enough.
Okay, so back to Lightroom. So I didn't do the last update. I didn't do the one with the wonky import dialogue and all the problems and stuff because I heard how many problems everybody was having. And I was like, I don't want any of that. So I skipped out on that one. And when this last fix for that came out, I went ahead and installed it. It's really been working really well. It seems to be a little bit snappier than the previous version that I was running, which was, I guess, a 6.0. Is that right? I don't know. I think it was 6.0. It was
probably 6.1.
It's okay, 6.1. And it seems a little bit snappier in some places. I actually really like having that dehaze on an adjustment brush. I know people were making fun of but it's awesome. You can paint fog into your photos. It's pretty slick without going into Photoshop. So I'm actually enjoying that. I like having that on a graduated filter. Really, other than that, I haven't noticed a whole lot of changes. Import dialog is exactly the same. It's running fine. I haven't had a single problem with it. So it's all good news on my end.
Yeah, I have had a similar experience with it. For me, everything is working great. After I switched my cache to 70 gigabytes, like several blog posts recommends, everything has gone really, really well. I did run out of application memory at one point. And I'm not sure which program had the memory leak that caused that, because I have a lot of RAM in my computer. But everything seems to be running pretty well in Lightroom. I still would like to see Lightroom work on speed, but it doesn't feel buggy right now. Right now, I'm having pretty good results with Lightroom. So for me, I say go ahead and update.
Cool.
The good news is it feels to me like the engineers really focused on performance and stability this release. No new features, no new things that are being added. That's what we wanted. We wanted them to focus on stability, make it so it works right, works well. And I think that they heard enough from a lot of people saying, you know, the import thing was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. It was people were really not happy with it for a lot of reasons for a long time. And when they went and just changed that import, then people are like, I can't stand it anymore. I've got to go tell Adobe that I hate this. Mm-hmm. And they really, really did. It was amazing to watch the forum about how many people let them know that this was just not acceptable. And I think they learned their lesson because of that. So I think all of us should have a bit of a pat on the back here that we let them know this was not good. And this is like serious stuff for us. This is not a toy or something that we have just have a lot of fun with. For a lot of people, this is serious. And so I hope that what it means is as they continue to make releases, we're going to see an emphasis on stability more than we have in the past. And I agree. I think what I should do is go and update the post now. I posted on improvephotography.com at the beginning of the week when the update was released that we gave it kind of a caution flag because we hadn't had time to try it out and validate that it was all good. And I've used it tonight to do a bunch of portrait editing. The good thing is it wasn't in my way. So a lot of times when there's been problems with it, I get really frustrated because I'm sitting there waiting for it and I didn't even notice waiting, which means I don't know if it's faster or not, but at least I didn't notice it this time. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's doing a lot better. And, you know, hats off to Adobe for listening to the users. When I posted an article about the Lightroom import speed, I had an email, you know, literally within, you know, 2 or 3 hours from an Adobe engineer saying, hey, let's fix this. So, I mean, really, that's pretty cool. I'm glad to see that they're taking it seriously and really working to improve that. All right. Well, that does it for our subjects of the week. And now the very most loved part of the episode, the doodad of the week. Darren, what do you have for us?
Well, like I talked about earlier, we need to keep that camera gear sharp. So mine's 3 doodads in 1, and I'll link all of these in the show notes. But the first one I recommend is the lens pen. And it's the NLP-1 lens pen. You pretty much just pop out a brush. It's great for getting all the nooks and crannies along your camera body where your lens butts up against the camera body itself where the seals are. Also, I recommend using a Gitzo's Rocket Air Blaster to blow out any of those areas the brush doesn't get to. And last but not least, don't spend money on cleaning your own sensor. Don't use liquids. Just take a look at these pec pads that we're linking you to. It's 100 lint-free pec pads. You put them around your finger, or you put them around maybe a popsicle stick with some scotch tape, sticky side down, and then you can go in there and make sure that you get all the dust off your sensor, and you already have pretty much brand new clean gear ready to go for when the warmer does allow you to shoot more often.
Very cool. My recommendation for this week is a dumb battery charger. And by that, I just mean one that's not too smart for its own good. So when you, if you're a photographer, you have a ton of batteries going everywhere for your speed light, for your trigger, for your remote release, for microphones, all kinds of stuff always takes batteries. And so I use rechargeables now that the listeners have shamed me into. I used to just buy them off the shelf and use them and throw them away so I didn't have to mess with it. But people told me that was bad for the environment and I hung my head in shame and changed. All right. So I use a ton of rechargeables now. And the problem is some of those smart chargers will not charge a AA battery or a AAA battery if it's fully discharged. If you fully discharge the battery, sometimes those smart chargers don't do a good job of getting it going. And so my recommendation is for the Range Clean battery organizer. It's just something that you slip in your drawer to put all your batteries in that organizes them nicely. And what I like about it is it has a voltage tester on it. So you just hook it up to the battery, just clip it in there, and it will show you if that battery is good or bad. And then you can test from your smart charger on the voltage meter to see if it really makes sure each battery is actually getting a charge before you put it in the organizer. And if you find one just is not charging, even though it's been on the charger, try it in one of those dumb old chargers, just those cheap ones. Sometimes I find that those actually get it going again and then it'll work fine. So that's a little bit of AA 101. Nick, what do you have?
So I've got 3 websites this week. As everybody knows, I love photographing waterfalls. And the way I scout my waterfalls are using these websites. So the first one, if you're in the Pacific Northwest, it's just waterfallsnorthwest.com. It's a survey of every single waterfall in the Pacific Northwest. And it tells you how hard it is to get there, shows a photo of it, describes the hike, gives you all the different details on it. If you're somewhere outside the Pacific Northwest, if you go to worldofwaterfalls.com, they have an interactive map where it just has a pin on every single waterfall. You can zoom in, get some details on it, descriptions of the hike to get to it, all that stuff. And then a new website that I've just found that it seems like it's a newer website with not a whole lot of entries yet, but the entries that they do have are these big, nice write-ups. It's called outdoorproject.com and a whole bunch of descriptions of not just waterfalls, but scenic vistas and all kinds of stuff. And it's primarily a hiking website, but a lot of times that's the information you need because you need to know, like, you know, can Nick get his fat self down this hike and make it out alive? So I'm always looking up information like that. So those are the 3 websites I have: outdoorproject.com, worldofwaterfalls.com, and waterfallsnorthwest.com.
Very good. Jeff?
All right. And this one might be a little bit premature because I haven't used it on a shoot yet. That's what I'm going to be doing the day before Thanksgiving. But it's the Young Newell YN560-TX flash controller. And I for my Canon. And what I like about this is I'll be able to set up the flashes in groups so that I can control them that way by the groups. And so I'm really excited to have something a bit smarter in the hot shoe of the camera for controlling the flashes than just the plain trigger.
Very good. And we have an in-depth review that I wrote on the YN560TX, which is highly, highly recommended. If you own a YN560, you really need one of these. And it's very inexpensive. So we'll link to that in the show notes, or just search for a YN560TX review on Google and we'll probably come up. So thank you for joining us in this episode of Improved Photography. This is the pre-Black Friday week. So come check. Don't forget, on Black Friday, right at midnight, we will have the orders available on improvephotography.com for the Lightroom Steel 2016. Thanks for joining us in this episode, and we'll see you in another 7 days.